All right. Let's jump in. Last week, I kind of put most of the pieces of the puzzle we put back together. Just a couple of loose ends. But what we had come away with was a sense that the story as it unfolds, Agag becomes a kind of a symbol to a much deeper part of the story, and that when Shaul shows up when Shmuel shows up in Gilgal, I'm going to do this until we get into David, then I'm free. when Shmuel shows up with Shaul, and Shaul defends that he did what he was supposed to do, etc., Shmuel starts to grope around what the source of the problem is, starts with the cattle and the spoils of war, and then hears that the issue is much more pervasive than that. It's about Agag. Realizes that what Shaul had done was conducted a very different campaign than what he was sent to do. And the way we described it was, instead of going through the entire region with an enormous army and going literally, to borrow a phrase from a different environment, cave to cave, in order to remove Amalek as a threat to Israel, he saw the new developing city, state, king of Shaul as a kind of a symbol of Malchus. And so he attacked the city, and he took out the king, and he captured him, and he conducted the war the same way he would have conducted any other military campaign against a foreign power. Ammon, Moab, Edom, he fought many of those kinds of wars, saw Amalek no differently than any of those campaigns, and therefore captured the king and stopped. And the stopping was the key to the story. The fact that it wasn't that he didn't finish the last remaining single Amalekite left so that the population could continue on a genealogical side. It was a much more pervasive issue. He actually only campaigned against the main city of Amalek. The rest of it was he treated them like a nation. He treated them like a nation with a king and an army. You take out the king, you take out the army, you capture the flag, you're done. It's like a game of Stratego. But it doesn't work that way in the world of the nomadic tribes of Amalek. And there, if you don't go and campaign literally tribe to tribe, region to region, you are going to keep Amalek, for the most part, totally intact and ultimately remain a threat for many years to come. So that we saw was the crux of the issue. And once Shaul hears, let's do that again, once Shmuel hears that, once Shmuel hears that Agag was kept alive, realized immediately what had transpired, and then goes on the offensive against Shaul. So there are three subtopics, sort of loose ends at the end of this discussion. One is a reflection of the story of the spoils. Because even if the story is about Agag, there's still a subtext. And the subtext is this cattle that gets part of the conversation. When Shaul first defends himself and he says, I've done what you've told me to do, Shmuel's immediate response is, well, if that's the case, why is there all this cattle? So clearly the cattle is a problem. The spoils of war are in some regard a problem for the unfolding of the story. Even if the centerpiece and the main point of the Chet of Shaul is the capture of Agag, but we can't ignore the fact that Shmuel picks up on the cattle from the very beginning as a problem. Unfortunately, Shaul gets fixated on that cattle, and then he can't get off of it. He thinks that's the whole picture of the Chet, until Shmuel finally has to set him straight to explain to him that, no, there's a much deeper problem. But nonetheless, the spoils are a part of the conversation between Shmuel and Shaul. And I already showed you, I think we looked at the text in Periklamet, that when David fights against Amalek, he takes the spoils without hesitation. And he divides them up amongst his soldiers. So clearly there isn't a fundamental problem with taking spoils of war from Amalek. Again, despite the language of the Torah that you have to destroy Amalek, or the language of the instruction to destroy Amalek until the last animal, which again we talked about more symbolic than literal. Nonetheless, the question becomes, why was there a problem for Shaul and his army and his people to take spoils of war, whereas for David and his army, there wasn't a problem to take the spoils of war against the same enemy? That's essentially the sub-question. Again, the main issue was clearly Agag. He fought a very different campaign than what he was expected to fight. But nonetheless, the spoils are part of that conversation. And so the question that I wanted to raise, sort of our first of the three sort of loose ends that I wanted to kind of fill in, is what was the problem with Shaul and his army taking of the spoils where David was allowed to? So what are our options?
Was that a different time?
Meaning?
Maybe the issues were different?
A year and a half later, 2 years later, David is in a different position. Maybe he hadn't given an instruction by the Navi not to take the spoils. Different circumstances, different conclusion. Possible. Very possibly something... Was there something else, perhaps, in the nature of the way the story is reflected, or the story is told? So the truth is, it's not the first time we've had a conversation about the problem of spoils. Spoils are a constant issue in Tanakh. When are you allowed to take the spoils of war, and when are you not? If you remember all the way back to Yoshua, for those who were with us when we did Yoshua, the very first battle Israel ever fought in the land of Israel was Yericho. And there Yoshua had made a very clear statement that nobody was allowed to take of the spoils of war. Remember that?
Yeah.
Decree? That decree led to a problem. What was the problem? So long ago. These are our... It was
some
a long time ago.
Some of us are of a certain age.
Right.
That's okay. That's okay.
If we remember to come, if I remember to come here.
What was the issue with Yericho? So Yericho, if you remember Yoshua, let's go back to Perek. Perek Vav, Yeshua Perek Vav. Starting with Pasuk Tet Zayin. Vayhi b'yom ha-shvi'i, you have it? Vayhi b'yom ha-shvi'i v'yashkimu kalot ha-shachar. Remember how they took down Yericho, the walls of Yericho, with the trumpets surrounding the city 7 days. And on the 7th day, 7 circuits. Vayashkimu kalot ha-shachar, vayasabu et ha'ir kemishpat hazeh 7 pamim. Rak v'yamahu savavu et ha'ir 7 pamim. Each day they surrounded the city 1 day, one time. This day they surrounded the city 7 times. Vayayom b'pam ha-shvit takua kohanim b'shofarot. In the 7th circuit around Yericho, they began to blow the shofar. Sort of create a mini earthquake, I guess. Vayomer Yehoshua el ha'am hariu ki netan Hashem lechem ha'tir. Now blast, because God has given you this city. V'yaita ha'ir cherem, hi v'chol asher ba la Hashem. This city is a cherem. What does a cherem mean? It's off limits. It's off limits. You may not touch the spoils. All that is there will go to God, meaning to the temple. Rak Rachav Zonat Tichyeh, and Rachav herself, who saved the spies, that she can live. Everybody else needs to fight. Pasuk Yedchet, Verak Atem Shimru Min Acherem. But you be careful. Don't take of the cherem, of the forbidden spoils of war. Pentacharimu, ulekachtem min acherem. Because if you take of this cherem, isamtemet machanei Yisrael lecherem, you will cause the destruction of the camp of Israel. It's a verse that has the play on the word cherem in three different forms. Mm-hmm. We talked about that way back when. Right, varachtem oto. So Yeshua makes it very clear from the outset, this city is off limits. All of the gold and the silver and the copper and everything that's in the city goes to the temple. Otzar Hashem Yavo. As the battle unfolds, what happens? The beginning of Perek Zayin. Vahi Hashem et Yoshua. God is with Yoshua. Vahi Shamo b'chol haaretz. His name was going throughout the land. He was famous. Vayimalu v'nei Yisrael mal b'cherem. Vayikach Achan ben Karmi ben Zavdi ben Zerach Tamatei Yehuda min acherem. Vayichar haf Hashem b'Yisrael. Somebody violated the cherem. Achan, and all of that unfolds in the next story of Ai, and the failure of the battle of Ai, etc., and the blame that gets placed on Achan's shoulders. So, amongst the various questions that we asked in that story was what was so significant about Yericho, for which Yeshua insisted that there be a cherem placed and on the spoils, and nobody would be allowed to touch the spoils. And the first person to touch the spoils was going to cause the sort of undermine the campaign of Israel. Again, similar kind of scenario where the instruction to the army, in this case to the army as a whole given by Yoshua, in our case by Shmuel given to Shaul, was the battle without the spoils. The moment he took the spoils, he seemed to have, you'll pardon the pun, spoiled the event.
So the spoils can be either cattle or the silver and gold.
Correct.
In other words.
Correct, seems to be. There's a third.
Or the people.
Excuse me?
Or the people. Or this is just physical things.
Usually, when we talk about spoils, we usually talk about physical things. I mean, there is a notion of Eshet Yefatoar and in terms of people's servants, etc., but certainly not of the Amei Canaan. That's exactly what the Torah forbade in the context of the nations of Canaan. So the question is there a connection between these two moments in which the prohibition of the spoils was articulated and what the difference is between them? And in a sense, you could raise the same question there as that we raised with Yerich, with Amalek, because there was no such instruction given for the subsequent battles of the subsequent cities. It's just Yerich. So it could be something unique about Yerich. So we suggested possibly that Yerich was some sort of a religious temple, religious city, and that all the spoils of war were items that were used in idolatry and therefore forbidden, maybe. Or there could be a pattern that reflects a deeper issue. But there's one more example of in Tanakh that we've studied so far in which we find this issue of the prohibition against taking of these spoils in some capacity. And that is the story of the Battle of Michmas. Remember actually we just did that, it was a couple of weeks ago. That was the story with Yonatan and the battle, where the two chapters, the battle against the Plishtim, and Yonatan is fighting in one place and Shaul is fighting in another. And they're hungry, and Shaul insists that they're not allowed to take of the spoils and they can't take of the animals. And they go into this forest, and he insisted that they take an oath that they can't take that they not eat of the food of the forest, and Yonatan takes of the food.
Right.
So what's going on? What is it about the spoils of war that's such a dramatic piece of all of these stories? So I want to show you one more story that we haven't looked at, and the kind of what we'll call the Ketuvah Shlishi, or sort of the resolution of all of these as a possibility, resolution of all of these examples. Here's a really out-of-the-box source. Okay, let me just pass those down. This is taken from the book of the Maccabees. Now, we are jumping time frame way out of sync, right? Book of the Maccabees, we're talking about Second Temple period, we're talking about Chanukah, it's a whole different story. So, just independent of everything we've learned, just kind of put yourself into a different mindset. We're now talking about the campaign of the Maccabees against the Romans. But here's a little episode. And in this episode, I think you find a resolution to a lot of this mystery. So I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just pieces of it. Georgius took 5,000 infantry and 1,000 picked cavalry, and this division moved out by night to fall upon the camp of the Jews and attack them suddenly. Men from the citadel were his guides. But Judas heard of it. Judas is
Yehuda
Maccabee, correct? And he and his mighty men moved out to attack the king's forces in Emmaus. Emmaus is one of the major battles, where the division was still absent from the camp. When Georgius entered the camp of Judas by night, he found no one there, so he looked for them in the hills, because he said the men are fleeing from us. At daybreak, Judas appeared in the plains with 3,000 men, but they did not have armor and swords such as they desired. So here's the army of the Greeks and the army of Yehuda HaMaccabee. Yehuda is unarmed sufficiently, and the Greeks are an army that is armed to the teeth, and cavalry and choice cavalry, etc. And they saw the camp of the Gentiles strong and fortified with cavalry round about it. These were trained men trained in war. But Judas said to the men who were with them, "Do not fear their numbers or be afraid when they charge. Remember how our fathers were saved at the Red Sea when Pharaoh with his forces pursued them. Now let us cry to heaven to see whether he will favor us and remember his covenant with our fathers and crush this army before us today." Sefer Maccabim, just as a kind of an aside, reads very much like a book of Tanakh. It has a style very similar to a book of Tanakh. It's part of the whole conversation about the Apocrypha, but that's a different conversation. "Then all the Gentiles will know that there is one who redeems and saves Israel. When the foreigners looked up and saw them coming against them," meaning the Greeks, "they went forth from their camp to battle. Then the men with Judas blew their trumpets, right? They're attacking, and engaged in battle. The Gentiles were crushed and fled into the plain, and all those in the rear fell by the sword. And they pursued them to Gazara and to the plains of Idumia's Edom, and to Azotus and Jamnia, and 3,000 of them fell." So now Israel is in the pursuit, the Greeks are on the retreat. "Then Judas and his force turned back from pursuing them," meaning they were running after the enemy, "and he said to the people, 'Do not be greedy for plunder. There is a battle before us. Georgius and his force," I'm not sure how to pronounce it, "and his force are near us in the hills, but stand now against our enemies and fight them, and afterwards seize the plunder boldly." Just as Judas was finished the speech, a detachment appeared coming out of the hills. They saw their army had been put to the flight, and the Jews were burning the camp, and for the smoke that was seen, it showed what had happened. When they perceived this, they were greatly frightened, and when they also saw the army of Judas draw up on the plain for the battle, they all fled into the land of the Philistines. Then Judas returned to plunder the camp, and they seized much gold and silver, and clothed, dyed, blue, and sea, purple, and great riches. And they sang hymns and praises to God, for he is good, and his mercy endures forever. Thus Israel had a great deliverance that day. So, what's the answer? Right. It's all about timing.
A sword and a chalice at the same time.
Correct. It's all of, and the key is the story of the battle of Yonatan and Shaul at Michmas. Because what happened there was, the moment the battle ended, do you remember the story? The moment the battle, the day, the sun set, and the battle stopped, and the people were hungry, they pounced on the spoils like there was no tomorrow, and they started to eat the animals with the flesh, with the blood. Remember that whole description, and Shaul has to go, and he has to stop them, and he has to slaughter the animals properly, etc., because they're tired and hungry. The moment you give an untrained army the opportunity to stop and plunder, you'll never get them back to campaign. You'll never get them back on their feet. So you have to drive the army until the campaign is done. Then you can take the spoils of war. And that's precisely what Yehoshua was concerned about at Jericho. It was an enormous victory at Jericho. But Yeshua was very concerned that if you let them stop of the spoils of war at that moment, Kriyat Yamsuf style, if you let them stop, you'll never build back the momentum for the next campaign. And so he prohibits them from taking of the spoils of Jericho. Not now. We have to move past Jericho and move on. And I think that that's precisely what the dynamic here is with Shaul. In Shaul's mindset, there's nothing wrong with taking the spoils. Why?
It's what's done.
Because the battle's over. Because the battle's over. He's captured the king, the war is done. They essentially surrendered, and we declared victory. We declared victory. The spoils are fair game. David takes the spoils from Amalek, because the war was over. The army fled. He had destroyed the whole army except for 400 who survived. The war was over. What Shaul doesn't realize, and that's part of the conversation between Shaul and Shmuel, is when Shmuel shows up and he says to him, Shmuel doesn't know what happened, but he knows one thing. Shaul didn't do what he was supposed to do. He was supposed to destroy Amalek. He didn't do it. Doesn't know why, doesn't know how, but he knows that God told him, Shaul failed, didn't destroy Amalek. If he hasn't destroyed Amalek, which means the mission's not over, why are the cattle? Why are the spoils? Spoils indicate that the battle's over. And that's why Shaul, the first thing Shmuel says to Shaul is, if you've done what you were supposed to do, then why are there all this cattle around? That's an indication that the battle's over, but that can't be true. He says, oh, well, we brought them to bring Korbanot. Okay, but that doesn't explain the battle. He says, well, we captured Agag and declared victory. Oh, now I get it. You captured Agag, meaning you fought your own little tiny personal war out in the city of Amalek, and you left the rest of the campaign of Amalek and the rest of the tribes of Amalek intact. Now we understand. So you took the spoils of war thinking the war was over because you captured Agag. So the pieces of the puzzle come back together, assuming that the spoils are an indication that in Shaul's mind, the war was over, whereas from Shmuel's perspective, capturing the king does not declare victory. That's Ir Amalek. You've got an entire tribe of Amalek that's still out there and still needs to be addressed. So that issue, the spoils of war, is an indication or a symbol or a simon that there's a much deeper issue, as we've talked about with Agag, but it's reflected in the conversation about the spoils. So that was the...
Why didn't Shaul, when he heard the cattle, think that the whole battle had been fought? When he heard him, he could have thought that everything had been won. Why did he continue to ask
Who's Shmuel? Because God had told him that...
Oh.
Right? Remember, God has said to him, Shaul failed. Didn't do what he was supposed to do. Shmuel doesn't know what the depth of the chait was, but he knows that Shaul failed in his mission to destroy Amalek.
Yes.
That's all he knows.
Right, okay.
Right. So clearly, if he failed to finish to destroy Amalek, the battle's not over.
Right. Okay.
The extent to which Shaul had failed, Shmuel's unaware, and that's why he's trying to figure it out.
Okay. And they even miss each other because Shaul's busy setting up a monument.
Well, he has to come and he gets redirected, right? So clearly there's a disconnect. Okay. Piece number one. Piece number two. Let's go to the end of the parak. Starting with Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Parak Tetvav, Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Vayomer Shmuel, sorry, Vayomer Shaul el Shmuel. After Shmuel's harsh rebuke, Shaul turns to Shmuel and he says, Chatati, ki avarti et pi Hashem v'et dvarecha. I've sinned, I've transgressed, I've violated God's command, I've violated your command. Ki hareiti et ha'am v'eshma b'kulam. So I feared the people and I listened to them. Again, Shaul has a hard time with Chatati. Remember this verse, because we will come back to it many, a little bit later, when we get to David and Bathsheba, which is in Shmuel Bet, so we've got a while to go. But when David is confronted with the depth of his chait, his tshuva and his declaration of Chatati is a very different Chatati than Shaul's. Shaul's Chatati reads almost like, I've sinned, but. I've sinned, I transgressed. Why? I was afraid of the people. I was too weak. I listened to them. Shaul, you still don't get it. It's not about the people, and it's not about listening to the people, and it's not about the cattle, and it's not about the spoils. It's about a perversion of the entire campaign. Shaul still doesn't hear it, he doesn't get it, he doesn't process it, they're in different worlds.
In a way, it's so human, because most people, if they do something wrong, they'll say, I did something wrong, and then they'll give you an excuse why they
Correct.
Did something wrong. They Correct. Will never say, I did something wrong,
Correct.
Period.
And that's the greatness of David. Right? It's human, and it's understandable, but it highlights the fundamental difference between Shaul and David.
So it takes me back to Haran and the golden calf.
Right.
Where he's same.
Similar idea. The weakness of listening to the people, but in Aaron's case, that really was part of the chait, whereas here, I don't think that listening to the people on the spoils of the cattle was the source of the chait at all. Right? Shaul, the fact that they led a different campaign and Shaul declared victory after capturing the Agag had nothing to do with listening to the people.
This is just his excuse,
correct,
though.
Because he still doesn't see it.
V'yata
sana at chatati v'shuv imi v'eshtachave l'Hashem. Now, forgive me. Forgive my sin. Come back with me. And let's go hand in hand. We'll make up. We'll make shalom. I'm sorry. I apologize. Let's move on. V'yomer Shmuel al Shaul lo ashuv imach. Shmuel says, I am not coming back with you. Ki ma'aseh dvar Hashem ma'aseha Hashem yot melech ha'Yisrael. For the third time. God has rejected you as king. You have rejected God. I am not going back with you. Vayisav Shmuel lelechet. Shmuel turned to leave. Vayachazek b'knaf mi'ilo vayikara. He grabbed hold of the edge of his cloak and it tore. I'm not translating more yet. I'm not going
That's
there.
Right.
I'm not going there. Okay. I will in a few moments. Vayomer elav Shmuel. Shmuel said to him, "Kara Hashem et mamlachut Yisrael mealecha hayom unetana lereacha atov bimeka." God has torn asunder your kingdom from you and given it to your friend, your rea, your neighbor, your other, who is better than you. The Eternal One of Israel does not lie, does not regret, is not a person who changes his mind. This is it. Shaul again says, Vayomer, Chatati, I've sinned. Ata, Kabdenina neged Zikneami v'neged Yisrael. Honor me in the presence, at least, minimally, in the presence of the Zikanim. Come back with me. If I come back and you're not with me, everybody will know that I've been rejected. Veshuvimi, v'shtachaveti l'Hashem alokecha. Come back so I can, with me, I'll bow to God. Vayashav Shmuel acharei Shaul, vayishtachu Shaul l'Hashem. Shmuel turned back from Shaul, walked off, and Shaul was left alone to go and back to the Mishkan. I'm going to come back to this little episode in a moment. I just want to do one more piece, and then we'll come back to it. Vayomer Shmuel, agishu elayet agag melech Amalek. Shmuel said to his people, bring me Agag. Vayelech elav Agag ma'adanot. They brought him Agag. Ma'adanot is an interesting word. Is it a place? Does it mean in chains? Does it mean joyful? It's not clear what ma'adanot means. But let's assume for the moment it means that he was in chains. Vayomer Agag, achen sar hamavet. Mar hamavet. Sar mar hamavet. I'm going to translate that phrase in a moment. Vayomer Shmuel, kasher shikla nashim charabecha ken tishkal minashim imecha. Vayishasef Shmuel et Agag lifnei Hashem b'Gilgal. As you have caused mothers to be bereaved from their sons, so your mother shall be bereaved more than any others. And he takes his sword and he kills Agag there in Gilgal. Vayelech Shmuel Ramata. Shmuel goes back to Ramah. Veshaul alal beto givat Shaul, and Shaul went home. Velo yasaf Shmuel lirot at Shaul ad yomoto. Never again will Shmuel see Shaul until the day of his death. You will never meet up with him again. Ki itabel Shmuel el Shaul. Shmuel mourned for Shaul. Shmuel loved Shaul. And this loss was a devastating loss for him. And he mourned for him. V'Hashem nicham ki imlichet Shaul ha'Yisrael. God had rejected Shaul as king. There's a couple of postscripts to the story of Amalek in this little half a chapter. I'm going to work them backwards. Let's deal with Agag first. Shmuel kills Agag. Obviously, killing Agag at this point in time is not going to solve the problem of Amalek. Despite the Midrashic perspective that the only one of Amalek that was preserved was Agag, and Shmuel kills Agag, and that's the end of Amalek. Clearly, that's not the case. We've seen that. So why does he kill him? So why does Shmuel kill him?
To show the people
as a symbol.
As a show.
Right? To undo the problem that Shaul had wanted to do, which was to subjugate subjugate Agag. Now I really got him confused. Right? Was to subjugate Agag, put him into jail, hold on to him in chains, and be able to wave him around like a trophy. So that's not going to happen. Agag is not blameless. He's not just the king of Agag, just some ordinary band of tribal people walking through the desert. And Agag is Melech Amalek. And with all that Amalek has done over the years, this is an individual who needs to be addressed. And Shmuel says to him, Kasher shikla nashim charbecha, ken tishkal minashim imecha. You have caused countless mothers to be bereaved of their sons over the years, as Amalek is wont to do. So this is turnaround. This is now payback. So Shmuel executes.
It's not just an execution. It's pretty.
It's public. It's clear.
And
it's public. It's clear. The man is guilty of countless. This is war. And in war, this is what this is a military right. The war is not over, and he takes him and he kills him. This is in the framework of the Torah. This would be standard. Right? You cannot capture the enemy. You have to either they can either leave or you can destroy them. But an enemy like Agag or like Amalek needs to be put to death. I have no mercy for Agag. I have no compassion for Agag. Agag was a cruel, murderous. Just from Shmuel's response, you see it, right? Kasher tishkal minashim charbecha. And how many? Kasher shikla nashim charbecha. How many people had Agag over the years killed, executed, captured, sold as slaves, which is in a sense worse than death. Shmuel has no compassion for Agag, kills him. But in the moment before Shmuel does so, Agag articulates something which is very strange. He says, "Vayomer Agag, achen sar mar hamavet." What does achen sar mar hamavet mean? So here the Mefarshim translate this phrase in almost diametrically opposed ways, because mar hamavet is easy to translate, the bitterness of death. Sar is a much harder word to translate, because, as we'll see in the Mefarshim, it can mean two opposing things. It can mean, depends what the root is. So leaving aside whatever they translate over there, because that's not, right, the translations here are going to mislead us. But if you look at the source page that I gave you, just to show you briefly, sources 1, 2, and 3 are three different Mefarshim, and they all translate this phrase differently. Rashi. Achen sar ma hamavet, says Rashi, this is in the language of, in the mindset of Agag, be'emet yadati ki sar v'karev alai mirirut hamavet. The bitterness of death approaches. Radak. Achen sar ma hamavet, higia mirirut hamavet. Yadua. Ki lahamito eviyot alav. He knew that he was being brought to Shmuel to be killed, and he says, indeed, the bitterness of death approaches. The word sar in this translation comes from the root. When Moshe looks at the burning bush, and he says, Vayomer, asura na ve'er'e, etamareha gadol hazeh madua lo yivarasne. I will turn to see this great vision, why this bush does not burn. Why it burns, but it does not get consumed. Asura is to turn. So sar mahamavet, the bitterness of death is turning towards me. It's approaching. Okay? Now, the Rabag translates this word from a different root. Vayomer Agag, achen sar mahamavet, idme shagag aya yare kishehigishuhu lifnei Shmuel. It seemed that that Agag was originally afraid when they brought him before Shmuel. Asur v'nikshar b'chavlei barzel, chained as he was. V'kashera Ashmuel, when he saw Shmuel, v'hayta tzurato muchachat al godel chasiduto v'rachmanuto, and he saw Shmuel, and he saw his greatness, and he saw his piety, and he saw his righteousness. Amar, be'emet sar mahamavet. The bitterness of death has now been removed. He's no longer afraid of the bitterness of death. Ki nefalti biyad mi shera'ui shirachem alai. I have fallen into the hands of somebody who's going to have compassion on me. When Shmuel realized that Agag thought that Shmuel was going to spare his life, Amarlo ki ena inyan ken. Then he said to him, "That's not the case. Ki kmo she'ata choshev, aval teda ki mo tamut mita achzarit. You will die. You will die cruelly." Because of all the cruel acts that you have done over the years. So sar mahamavet, says the Rabag, means that Shaul that Agag originally thought that he was going to be. Well, he originally thought before he came to Shmuel, he originally thought he was going to be tortured and held in jail and treated cruelly and treated bitterly and all. And now that he saw Shmuel, he says, Shmuel is going to have compassion on me. He's going to have rachmanas. He's going to be kind to me. He's going to have a navi. He's going to be, there's an aura around him. And Shmuel says to him, nothing to him. So what does that mean? So first of all, just to translate the word sar. Sar here doesn't mean the bitterness of death approaches. It means the bitterness of death
turns away.
Lasur can also mean to turn away. Like vayasar et ofen markvotav, vayinageo b'chvedut, in the Kriyat Yamsuf, when the wheels of the chariots were removed from the chariot as it was sinking in the mud. Vayasar, he removed the wheels of the chariot. Vayasar et ofen markvotav. So the word sar, can, depending on its root, can mean lasur, mean to turn to, or vayasar, or yasar, which is to turn away from. It's a question whether the it's a two-letter root that's missing its third letter. So the third letter is either a yud or a zvav. It depends on what the root is. So that, therefore, that gets confusing. But that's from a language perspective, that's why you have a machloket. But on a deeper level, what is Agag concerned with? Agag, and this is what I think the Rabbag is reflecting. Agag is very keenly aware of the standard practice of kings in those days. He's an Amalekite. He's keenly aware of what local, indigenous, Canaanite populations do to their captive kings. And he knew that he was going to be, the likelihood was, in his mind, that between Shaul or Shmuel, that he was going to have to suffer the same fate as all the other ancient kings in civilization when they are captured by their enemies. What is that fate? So, do you remember the beginning of Sefer Shoftim? As an example, beginning of Sefer Shoftim, you have this really strange description of Adoni Bezek. Remember Adoni Bezek? I'll show you Adoni Bezek. Just you're far away from breakfast and far away from lunch, and I can show you Adoni Bezek.
Great.
Perek Aleph.
Doesn't sound promising.
No. Shoftim Perek Aleph. They capture Adoni Bezek. Adoni Bezek was a Canaanite king. Yehudah is fighting Adoni Bezek, a big war in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim. They capture him. Vayan Pasuk Vav. Vayanas Adoni Bezek. Vayan Tefuah Achavav. They capture him. Vayan Chazuoto. They took him. And they cut off the toes of his hands and feet. Vayomer Adoni Bezek. Why do they do that? So Adoni Bezek said, "Shivim melachim beonot kedehem veraglehem mukutzatzim ayu melaktim tachat shulchani." There are 70 toes of 70 kings that are sitting in a cart or in a crate underneath my kitchen table, or underneath my palace table, as a symbol of all the kings whom I've captured and put into my jails. Kasher asiti ken shilam li. Elokim. As I have done to others, so has been done to me. So at least he gets it. Right? But the message, this was standard fare in the world of the Canaanites. Turnabout is fair play. This was what they did. They captured kings.
They marked them
and held them in their jails. Maimed and marked. I spoke on Shabbos morning about Bar Kokhba. Mm-hmm. One of the great critiques about Bar Kokhba was that he used to do that to his soldiers in his army.
He branded them.
I need that as a symbol of loyalty. This was standard fare in the world of the Canaanites. When Shimshon was captured, they blinded him and put him on as an ox to run the mill. Tzidkiyahu, when Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Bavel captures Tzidkiyahu, puts him in jail, and he takes his eyes out. This was standard fare. So Agag, in a sense, says he expecting to be tortured by the kings who captured him, because that's what he would have done to anybody else. When he sees Shaul, Samar Mavet. He says, here's Shmuel. When you see Shmuel, he says, "Samar Mavet." The bitterness of death is gone because you have compassion. So, in a sense, Shmuel did have compassion.
Well, he chained him, but he put him in jail.
Right? He didn't torture him. He killed him.
He didn't maim him.
Okay, he didn't maim him. He killed him. He deserved to be put to death. I have no issue with that. I wasn't going to torture him, because that's not what you do. Right? If he's guilty of execution, capital punishment is not... the Torah is not afraid of capital punishment, especially in a military context. He's a king of a foreign enemy who's done some terrible things over the years. So king to king, navi to soldier to soldier, you've killed him. But the notion of mar hamavet, of torturing him, of maiming him, of holding him in his jails, which was essentially what Shaul had tried to do, that Shmuel was not about to do. And so there is this distinction between the fate he would have met in the hands of Shaul and the fate he met at the hands of Shmuel. So he kills him, but at the same time, the message in the Perek is that there's a certain sense of compassion in the very process that Agag himself recognizes, correct, in Shmuel.
Yeah, so
that Agag himself recognizes.
Would Shaul have, if Shaul had not left, would he also have that compassion?
We don't know. We don't know what he was going to do with him in his jails. We do know that he captured him, and he says, "I captured him. He's alive in my jail." Like, we don't know what he would have done with him in his jail. But there is a dark side to Shaul, but it doesn't really come out until his civil war with David, and then you see the darker side of Shaul. But it's quite possible that kind of is a turn, like a psychological turning point for him. Okay, lastly. Perek, back to the earlier psukim that I skipped over. Vayomer, pasuk chav zayin. Vayisev Shmuel alechet, vayechazek beknaf mi'ilo, vayikaba. This is one of those incredibly ambiguous sentences. Because there's pronouns here that are completely ambiguous. Mm-hmm. The pronoun of who's doing the act of grabbing and tearing, and whose cloak. Okay, so let's read it again. Pasuk Chav Zayin. Vayisev Shmuel alechet. Shmuel turned to go. Vayachazek biknaf mi'ilo. He grabbed the edge of his cloak. Vayikara, and it tore. Vayomer elav Shmuel. Shmuel said to him, Kara Hashem et mamlochut yisom me'alecha. Hayom, God has taken your kingdom away from you. Has ripped away your kingdom. There are several episodes similar to this in Chumash, in Tanakh. It's another episode in which the symbol of the tearing of the cloak represents the tearing of the kingdom. We haven't learned it yet, so you're excused. But it is when the kingdom, when the decree of the split of the kingdom from Shlomo is prophesied by a Navi by the name of Achiah Shiloni. And that is in Malachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, I believe. Yud Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Chavtet, 11:29. At that time, the Yeravam Yetzam Yerushalayim, Yeravam was the upcoming rebellious young enemy or challenge to the throne. He was found by Achiah Shiloni the Navi, encountered him. And he was wearing a new cloak. And the two of them were alone in the field. Vayitpos Achiya basalma chadasha asher alav. Achiya grabbed the new cloak that was upon him. Vayikra'esh nemasar kra'im. And he tore it into 12 parts. Vayomer liyaravam, kach lecha asara kra'im. You take 10 of these torn parts. I'm going to tear apart the kingdom of Israel. I'm going to give 10 parts to you, and 2 parts I will remain for David, for Shlomo. The rest of the story I'm not going to read. It's not our issue for now. So a very similar type of message, the cloak symbolizing the tear of the kingdom. In the case of Yeravam, it was a tear in 10 parts because he wanted to demonstrate how many tribes would remain part of the northern kingdom of Israel versus how many tribes would remain in the southern kingdom of Judah. So it was a split of the kingdom. Here, it was not a tear into parts, it was just a tear to indicate that the kingdom was being torn away from him. But let me start with a question out there in the case of Yeravam and Achiya. There it's clear who tore the cloak.
Right.
Correct? It says. There it's clear who grabbed the cloak. Vaitpos Achiya basimla chadasha asher alav. Whose cloak was it?
That's not clear.
Right?
You just know who did it.
You just know who did it. It's not clear whether it's Yeravam's cloak that Achiya came and tore, or whether Achiya had put on this new cloak in order to tear it, in order to make this demonstration. It's unclear.
But that's very different than from what this is.
So this has a third level of ambiguity. Because it's not clear who grabbed it and tore.
Right.
So there are 3 possibilities in this story.
Here we go again.
Right? See it in the Mefarshim. 3 possibilities. You'll see it in the Mefarshim. Right, why are the 3? It should be 2. It's either Shaul grabbed the cloak and tore it, or Shmuel grabbed the cloak and tore it. So why are the 3?
He stepped on it.
because we don't know whose cloak it is.
Right, because we don't know whose cloak it is. What is clear is that Shaul did not grab his own cloak and tear it.
Right.
So either Shaul grabbed Shmuel's cloak, don't leave, mm-hmm. and Shaul rips it out of his hands and it tears. Shmuel rips it out of his hands and it tears. Or, as he's leaving, Shmuel grabs Shaul's cloak and rips it as a symbol. Or, as he's leaving, Shmuel grabs his own cloak and rips it as he's leaving. Each one of those interpretations gives a completely different picture to what took place. And that's the beauty of it. Let's take a look at the Radak. Vayechazek b'knaf mi'ilo. He grabbed his cloak. Says the Radak, option number 1. Shaul Hichzik b'knaf mi'il Shmuel k'day sheyashuv imo. Shaul grabbed Shmuel's cloak. Right? Shaul grabs Shmuel's cloak. I get confused all the time anyway, so this is even going to be more confusing. Shaul grabbed Shmuel's cloak in order that he should not turn away from him. Right? Mm-hmm. And it tore.
That's one.
That's one possibility. And so he says, this is an indication of what? And his response is, Kara Hashem et mamlechut Yisrael me'alecha. Meaning, it was a momentary act of, it was an accident. It's a fundamental difference. This interpretation and the other two is that it's not intentional. It's an accident.
Right.
Shaul reached out to grab him, and it happened to tear in his hands as Shmuel tugged away. Right?
And so then it's a sign.
And then it's a sign that, and Shmuel looks at that, and he looks at his cloak, and he looks at Shaul, and he says, this is an indication that there's a rift, that God has ripped apart the kingdom from you. It's also, by the way, an indication that there's a rift between Shaul and Shmuel themselves. Because here's two people who have been so close. Mentor, protege, relationship. And now he just, he'll never see him again. And he'll mourn for him until the end of his life. So, it's not, there are other, the role of cloak as a symbol of a relationship is very powerful. Think about for a moment the relationship between Eliyahu and Elisha. Remember the Eliyahu Hanavi goes up to heaven in a chariot of fire, and his greatest disciple was Elisha. And Elisha, as Eliyahu is going up to heaven, Elisha says to him, Eliyahu actually says to him, what can I give you, what can I offer you? And Elisha says, what I really want is to be pishnei minuchacha alai, which most translate as, I want double the amount of nevuah that you had, which doesn't make any sense for a disciple to say to his master, I want to be twice what you were. But we were to talk once about the word pi. The word pi doesn't mean twice, it means half. Pim. Remember that discussion about the pim? So pishnaim,
a coin, right?
Yeah. So pishnaim minuchachalai means, right? So pishnaim minuchachalai means half the ruach of yours, right? It's a biblical phrase. It says, I want to be half the man you are. To which he says to him, if you see me go up to heaven, then that's an indication that God will give you what you wish. And as he goes up, he throws down his aderet, he throws down his cloak. And Eliyahu picks up, and Elisha picks up Eliyahu's cloak, and he puts it on himself, his mantle. Right? The whole notion of a mantle is a symbol of leadership, or is a symbol of the notion of stepping into somebody else's shoes, or wearing somebody else's mantle. Right? It's a symbol of a connection. You tear that mantle, you tear that cloak, and you've teared apart the leadership, the symbol of Malchus, but at the same time, the relationship between them. So, It happens by accident, according to this interpretation, but it is a symbol of the tear that takes place in Shaul's kingdom, but also in the relationship between Shaul and Shmuel. Remember that Shmuel will never again serve as a Navi. Shmuel's time as a Navi comes to an end when Shaul's time as a king comes to an end. The Navim were designated to specific kings. Shmuel was the Navi of Shaul. When Shaul's reign comes to an end, Shmuel's time as a Navi comes to an end. David has his own Nevi'im. Shmuel will appoint David and then disappear from history. Because David has his own Nevi'im. One by the name of Natan and the other by the name of God. Shmuel is never David's Navi. And that's true throughout history. So it's a tragedy not only for Shaul, but the tragedy is felt by Shmuel himself. Option number one. Option number two. Ubamidrash cholkimbo. In the Medrash there's a dispute, there's a machloket. Yeshomim ki Shmuel kara b'me'il Shaul. That Shmuel, as he turns away from Shaul, gives him one last jolt, one last shtuch. You know what a shtuch is?
Yeah.
Okay, one last in your face. Okay? V'rimez lo bazeh ki mi sheyichrot knaf mi'ilo hu yimloch acharav. He says, this act of taking Shaul's cloak and tearing it is a foreshadowing. The one who's going to reign in his stead is going to do the same trick to him. Because twice, actually, David was an opportunity to kill Shaul as he's being chased by Shaul and is being pursued by Shaul. in the cave, Shaul has David has the opportunity for Turner, and he doesn't do it. What he does is he cuts off the edge of his cloak in order to demonstrate that he had the ability to kill Shaul, and he refused to do so. Okay, that so this act of Shaul is foreshadow of sorry this act of Shmuel is foreshadowing that future message of L'Re'acha Tov Mimecha. That other who's going to reign in your stead is going to do this to you. Okay. V'yeshamim, third possibility. Ki Shmuel karam mi'ilo al atzmo. Shmuel tore his own cloak. As he's turning away from Shaul, he takes his cloak and he tears it. His own cloak.
Yeah.
Why? Shechen darkan. Well, let me ask you before I even read the next line of the Radak. Why would Shmuel tear his own cloak?
It's in morning.
Morning. Kriya. Shechen derech shel tzadikim liyot korein b'sha'a she'ein niti'atan meshubachat. It's a really powerful phrase. Is the way of the righteous to tear kriya when their seedlings don't develop appropriately. When that which they planted doesn't take root. She'ein niti'atan meshubachat. Shaul is Shmuel's protege. He created him, he nurtured him, he watered him, he planted him. And it says, the last sentence, V'lo yasav Shmuel lirot etshul ad yom atos. Shmuel will never see Shaul again until the day he dies. Ki itabel Shmuel el Shaul. He mourned for Shaul his whole life. That's not an accidental term. He was an avelus for Shaul and for Shaul's failure for the rest of his life. And the last thing he does as he walks away from Shaul is he tears Kriya.
That's power.
That's the mess. That's the message. That's the takeaway from this parak. How much of a heartache it is. How heartbroken he is. Shmuel. Over Shaul's failure. And the last thing he does is he takes his cloak and he tears it. Mm. So he's... little brief redak. He pours into this. It's like, yeah, it's an unbelievable tragedy. All of the expectation of what Shaul was and could have been. You know, it's interesting. It's not the first time that Shmuel has told Shaul that his kingdom is coming to an end. And one of the questions that the Mefarshim struggle with is what the difference is between what Shmuel told Shaul back in Perek Yud and what he's telling him now. Because Shmuel's already said to Shaul once before, your kingdom is not going to survive. Take a quick glance. Back in Perek Yud, in Gilgal. Sorry, it's not Perek Yud. Perek Yud Gimel. That didn't look right. Right? In Gilgal. Pasuk Yud. I have got the Yud right somewhere. Yud 13:10. Read Gimel Yud. Vayi kichalotot lahalot ha'olah. Remember when Shaul was told to wait for Shmuel for 7 days in Gilgal, and he didn't wait, and he brought the sacrifices. V'nei Shmuel ban, the seventh day Shmuel showed up, v'yitzei Shaul likvato, and there again, Shmuel shows up. By the way, both stories are in Gilgal. Shmuel shows up in Gilgal, and Shaul goes running out to greet him, levarcha, and he says, oh, everything's great. Oblivious to the fact that he's made a terrible mistake. V'yomer Shmuel, me'asita. Vayomer Shaul, what did you do? He says, so Shaul says, Kireiti kinefatza am me'alai, the people were leaving. Notice the pattern. Right? There too, he was listening to the people instead of doing what was expected of him. Vayomer Shaul, Kireiti kinefatza am me'alai, v'yata lo vata lo mo'ed ha'yamim, and you didn't come, blame somebody else. Flishtim ne'asafim ichmas, The war will start and I didn't get a chance to bring a sacrifice. It's all about sacrifices. Back to if you compare the two stories, it's about sacrifices and about listening to the people and about blaming somebody else for his failures. The pattern is almost identical. You've been a terrible disappointment. You didn't listen to God's command. God would have made you your kingdom and established your kingdom forever. Now your kingdom shall not survive. God will seek another person who will be loyal to him, and he will make him leader of Israel. Because you didn't listen to what God commanded you. So there too, Shmuel said to him the same thing. He didn't use the phrase, L'riacha tov mimecha, but nonetheless, he said to him, God is going to appoint somebody else. So why is he so devastated now? He wasn't so devastated there. Why was he so upset now that he mourned? Why wasn't he so upset there? And how did we function between Perek Yud Gimel and Perek Yud Vav? So this question the Radak also addresses, source number 8, but what essentially the Radak suggests, and I'll summarize it because we have 3 minutes left, so I'll just summarize it for you. Well, essentially the Radak makes several suggestions. Number one, he said that back in Gilgal, which was early in the story, back when Shmuel made a decree, he said to him, your kingdom will be taken away. But there's always the possibility of tshuva. And Shmuel had hoped that Shaul would do tshuva, that Shaul would recognize that there's a change of heart. One possibility. Another possibility, he says to Radak, is that there it was early, meaning that Shmuel said to him, Lo takum mamlachtecha olam, your kingdom will not survive forever. That doesn't mean that it won't survive now. You can sit on your throne for years and years and years. And eventually it'll be taken, it'll go through somebody else. Another possibility that's not in the Radak, but I think I once mentioned to you, that a kingdom to survive, it doesn't necessarily have to go through the son, the heir to the throne. It could very well be that what God could have had Shaul done proper tshuva, and had Shaul changed the nature of the decree, Shmuel could have said to him, okay, the throne won't continue, the kingship won't continue through your progeny or through your son, but it'll go to David, but David was his son-in-law. So it's not impossible for the kingdom to continue, but via a different line within the family. In other words, the decree back in Perek Yud Gimel was harsh, but it wasn't final. It was an opportunity for Shmuel. It was a warning shot, and it was an opportunity for Shaul to figure out, to realize that he has an opportunity to change directions, and the gzeirah can be changed. But when he repeats the offense, with the dire consequences for generations, when he blames the people again, and he brings sacrifices instead of listening to God's command, and he second-guesses the Navi, and he does everything that he did back in Gilgal, but he does it again years later, this time the decree is final. And that's why he adds the phrase, V'gam netzach Yisrael lo yishaker v'lo yinachem, ki lo adam hu liyinachem. God is eternal. God is not changing his mind. This decree is final. And that causes Shmuel, literally rips at his heart. And so he takes his cloak, tears kriya, declares an act of mourning, ve'itabel al Shaul ad yomoto. That's the story of the end of Shaul.
So which interpretations really accepted then? The idea that Shmuel tore the cloak? Or
Radak offers three. I'm willing to buy all three because each one reflects a different message. I think in the pshat of it probably makes the most sense to suggest that Shaul grabbed Shmuel's cloak. Uh-huh. But in the depth of it, in the depth of it, the phrase about Vayitabel al Shaul an Yomato is an indication that this really was an act of mourning. Rabbi, we have come to the conclusion of our study of Shaul. The next unit, the second is what, 3 years? Is it 3 years we've been doing Shmuel?
I don't know.
No.
It's at least three.
3 years? Shmuel?
It's at least three.
Well, yeah. Whatever.
It's taken us three. It won't take us 3 years to go through the rest of Shmuel Aleph, but nonetheless, our next unit of study is the beginning of David. So we are going to adjourn now and reconvene B'ezrat Hashem in hopefully in September. But we are certainly going to go on hiatus now, because next week is Memorial Day.